Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Alice Bryant, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
New research has provided surprising details about the biology of Earth's largest fish, the whale shark. Scientists say that female whale sharks grow more slowly but reach a much larger size than males. Researchers recently said they had followed the growth of 54 whale sharks over 10 years. The creatures swam in the Ningaloo Reef off of Australia's west coast, where hundreds of the rare fish travel every year. Whale sharks of both sexes were found to have their fastest growth while young, about 20 to 30 centimeters per year. Males were found to grow faster than females. They reached about 8 meters in length at about 30 years old. At that age, they reach sexual maturity, meaning the fish were able to produce young. Females grew larger than males. Females reached about 14 meters at about age 50 when they reached sexual maturity. Mark Meakin is a marine biologist at the Australian Institute of Marine Science. He led the research that was published in Frontiers in Marine Science. Meakin described whale sharks as remarkable. He noted that females give birth to many young, up to 300 at one time. Our study provides the first evidence that male and female whale sharks grow at different rates, Meakin said. Whale sharks are filter feeders, meaning they take food and nutrients from the water. The longest known whale shark ever recorded reached a length of about 18 meters. Whale sharks can live for 100 to 150 years. Meakin suggested the study's findings were important for saving whale sharks. He noted that if it takes 30 or more years for the creatures to reach sexual maturity, there are lots of threats, such as hunting and ship strike, before they get a chance to breed. For that reason, Meakin described efforts to save the creatures as urgent. I'm John Russell.
Proposed legislation in Western Australia could cost companies millions of dollars for destroying heritage sites of native peoples. The fines would be part of big changes to laws meant to protect ancient Aboriginal sites. The proposal follows destruction of two rock shelters by mining company Rio Tinto earlier this year. The rock shelters were about 46,000 years old. The Aboriginal people considered them holy places. The proposed measure is called the Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Bill 2020. It would replace a 50-year-old law and removes a hotly debated part of the law. That measure stated that the government had the right to give permission to land users to destroy culturally important sites. The new measure says traditional indigenous groups will be given greater influence in the protection of their land. In the past, some groups had agreed to sacrifice holy sites to help indigenous communities get a share of mining profits. Rio Tinto is the world's biggest miner of iron ore. In May, the company destroyed two ancient rock shelters at Juukan Gorge in the Pilbara area of Western Australia. The two caves were considered one of Australia's most important areas for archaeological researchers. Indigenous leaders had strongly opposed development at the site. Opposition was so great, even among Rio Tinto's shareholders, that the head of the company and two top aides were forced to resign. The new legislation was being put together before the Juukan Gorge shelters were damaged. It promises a modern method of protecting Aboriginal cultural sites. Ben Wyatt is Western Australia's Minister for Aboriginal Affairs. He says mining companies such as BHP have already reacted well to the legislation. As a result of the Juukan shelter destruction, miners in important heritage areas have stopped work, Wyatt added, and you have seen BHP in particular announce that, he told VOA. If Western Australia lawmakers approve the proposal, the state could order fines of up to $7.2 million for unauthorized damage to Aboriginal sites. Robin Chappell is a lawmaker with the Australian Greens, a coalition of political parties. He said the bill involves a new and complex system that some Indigenous groups would have trouble studying quickly. The last day state lawmakers are taking public comment on the bill is October 9th. The Kimberley Land Council is one of Western Australia's biggest Indigenous organizations. It said the proposed law completely ignores Aboriginal people and their right to care for their heritage. Nolan Hunter is the head of the group. He told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation the measure could still lead to destruction like that seen at Juukan Gorge. He said the law would be useless when miners and Aboriginal people disagree on protection of heritage sites. I'm Alice Bryant.
Scientists say ice in the Arctic Ocean melted to its second lowest level on record this summer. Arctic sea ice melts over the summer, reaching its lowest point sometime during September. Then, during the winter, ice builds up again and reaches its highest level in March. The National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado Boulder uses satellite imagery to observe and measure the ice levels. The center recently announced its latest findings about sea ice levels at the North Pole, as well as areas off Canada, Greenland, Russia, and the U.S. state of Alaska. Researchers reported Arctic Ocean ice levels reached a summertime low of 3.7 million square kilometers on September 15th. That is the second lowest level recorded since 1979, when satellite observations of the sea ice began. The lowest level recorded was in 2012, when the ice shrank to 3.4 million square kilometers. In the 1980s, the ice cover was about 2.7 million square kilometers bigger than current summer levels. Mark Serez is director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center. It's been a crazy year up north, with sea ice at a near record low, he told the French news agency AFP. He noted the heat waves and massive forest fires in the Siberian area of Russia. He said the heat wave last spring and natural climate conditions in the Arctic played a part in the latest sea ice melt. He noted that temperatures for much of the year in the Siberian Arctic were 8 to 10 degrees Celsius above normal. Some of the warming was caused by the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas, he added. Absolutely, we're seeing climate change at work because the warm summers become warmer and the cold winters aren't as cold as they were, Serez said. Melting sea ice does not directly add to rising sea levels, but scientists say it can have a direct effect on rising temperatures. When the sea ice disappears, the incident sunlight gets absorbed in the ocean, helping to further warm the Earth, Claire Parkinson told AFP. She is a climate scientist with the U.S. space agency NASA. Parkinson added that the lower ice coverage this year was in line with the overall downward patterns of the past 40 years. What we are seeing here in the Arctic is really the opening up of a new ocean on top of the world, which means that we need to be protecting the area, she added. In another recent study, U.S. researchers suggested the Arctic has experienced such intense warming in recent decades that it is now changing to a completely new climate state. The study was carried out by the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research. The researchers said Arctic sea ice has seen such major melting in recent decades that even an unusually cold year will no longer have the amount of summer sea ice that existed as recently as the mid-20th century. The study predicted that autumn and winter temperatures will also warm enough to enter a statistically distinct climate by the middle of this century. This will likely result in seasonal changes to include months when rain will fall instead of snow. The scientists based their research on hundreds of detailed computer models and observations of Arctic climate conditions. They used this data to define climate conditions of what they considered the old Arctic. The team then attempted to identify future climate changes linked to human-caused warming. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. On March 4, 1829, Andrew Jackson was sworn in as president. The sky over Washington was cloudy that day, but the clouds parted and the sun shone through as Jackson began the ride to the Capitol building. Thousands of cheering supporters saw this change in weather as a good sign. So many people crowded around the Capitol that Jackson had to climb a wall and enter from the back. He walked through the building and onto the open area at the front where the ceremony would be held. The ceremony itself was simple. Jackson made a speech that few in the crowd were able to hear. Then Chief Justice John Marshall swore in the new president. In the crowd was a newspaper man from Kentucky, Amos Kendall. "It is a proud day for the people," Kendall wrote. "General Jackson is their own president." From the Capitol, Jackson rode down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House. Behind him followed all those who had watched him become the nation's seventh president. The crowds followed him all the way into the White House, where food and drink had been put out for a party. Everyone tried to get in at once. Clothing was torn. Glasses and dishes were broken. Chairs and tables were damaged. Never had there been a party like this at the president's mansion. Jackson stayed for a while, but the crush of people tired him, and he was able to leave. He spent the rest of the day at his hotel room in Virginia. The guests at the White House finally left after drinks were put on the table outside the building. Many of the people left through windows because the doorways were so crowded. Jackson was popular with many voters who saw him as representing the common man. But Jackson's first term seemed to be mostly a political battle with his own vice president, John C. Calhoun of South Carolina. Calhoun wanted to become the next president, but Jackson preferred his Secretary of State, Martin Van Buren. The split between Jackson and Calhoun deepened over another issue. Jackson learned that Calhoun had once called for Jackson's arrest. Calhoun wanted to punish Jackson for his unauthorized military campaign into Spanish Florida in 1818. The most important division between the two men was Calhoun's belief about who had more power, the states or the federal government. Calhoun came to believe the rights of the states were stronger than the rights of the federal government. His feelings became well known during a debate on a congressional bill. The year before Jackson took office, Congress passed a bill to require taxes on imports. The purpose of the taxes was to protect American industries. The state of South Carolina, Calhoun's state, opposed the measure. South Carolina, like other southern states, had almost no industry. It was an agricultural area. Import taxes would only raise the price of products the South imported. South Carolina refused to pay the tax. Calhoun wrote a long statement defending South Carolina's action. In the statement, he developed what was called the Doctrine of Nullification. The doctrine declared that the power of the federal government was not supreme. Calhoun argued that, instead, supreme power belonged to the states. He said states did not surrender this power when they approved the Constitution. In any dispute between the states and the federal government, he said, the states should decide what is right. Calhoun argued that if the federal government passed a law that any state thought was not constitutional or against its interests, that state could temporarily suspend the law. The other states of the Union, Calhoun said, would then be asked to decide the question of the law's constitutionality. If two-thirds of the states approved the law, the complaining state would have to accept it or leave the Union. If less than two-thirds of the states approved it, then the law would be rejected. None of the states would have to obey it. It would be nullified, canceled. Senators Robert Hayne of South Carolina and Daniel Webster of Massachusetts debated the question of nullification in Congress. Senator Hayne spoke first. He said that there was no greater evil than giving more power to the federal government. The major point of his speech could be put into a few words: liberty first, union afterwards. Senator Webster said Hayne had spoken foolishly. Liberty and union could not be separated, Webster said. It was liberty and union, now and forever, one and inseparable. No one really knew how President Andrew Jackson felt about nullification. He made no public statement during the debate. Leaders in South Carolina developed a plan to get the president's support. They decided to hold a big dinner honoring the memory of Thomas Jefferson. Jackson agreed to attend the dinner. The speeches were carefully planned. They began by praising the democratic ideas of Jefferson. Next, they discussed South Carolina's opposition to the import tax. Finally, the speeches were finished. It was time for toasts. President Jackson made the first one. He stood up, raised his glass, and looked straight at Vice President John C. Calhoun. He waited for the cheering to stop. "Our union," he said, "it must be preserved." Calhoun rose with the others to drink the toast. He had not expected Jackson's opposition to nullification. His hand shook, and he spilled some of the wine from his glass. Calhoun was called on to make the next toast. "The union," he said, "next to our liberty, most dear." He waited a moment, then continued, "May we all remember that it can only be preserved by respecting the rights of the states and by giving equally the benefits and burdens of the Union." President Jackson left a few minutes later. Most of those at the dinner left with him. The nation now knew how the president felt, and the people were with him, opposed to nullification. But the idea was not dead among some people in South Carolina. The nullifiers held a majority of seats in the state's legislature at that time. They called a special convention. Within 5 days, convention delegates approved a declaration of nullification. They said citizens of South Carolina need not pay the federal import taxes. The nullifiers also declared that if the federal government tried to use force against South Carolina, then the state would withdraw from the Union and form its own independent government.
This cut very deeply with Jackson. Jackson was a nationalist. He was a great believer in the federal union. He was a flag-waving patriot. And as Jackson saw it, nullification was the beginning of the end of the United States as a nation.
That was historian Daniel Feller. He says Jackson believed in a limited federal government. But that did not mean the people of every state should decide what the Constitution means.
That way lies chaos, as Jackson said. Either we have a national government or we don't. And if Congress does pass laws which might prove to be unconstitutional, we have a procedure for dealing with that. We have the Supreme Court. We have the ability of the people and their elected representatives to appeal to Congress to repeal those laws, to take them back. But you can't have every state going off on its own and deciding what the Constitution says.
Jackson wrote a proclamation answering the nullifiers. In it, he said, America's Constitution formed a government, not just an association or group of sovereign states. South Carolina had no right to cancel a federal law or to withdraw from the Union. Jackson explained that it was his duty as president to enforce the laws of the land. Even as Daniel Feller says, if he had to use force.
It's going to come to a test of arms, and then, and this I can quote, and it was in italics, underlined, emphasized in the printed version of the proclamation. Disunion by armed force is treason. Are you really ready to incur its guilt?
Jackson sent 8 warships to the port of Charleston, South Carolina, and soldiers to federal military bases in the state. While preparing to use force, Jackson offered hope for a peaceful settlement. In a message to Congress, he spoke of reducing the federal import tax that hurt the sale of Southern cotton overseas. He said the tax could be reduced because the national debt would soon be paid. Congress passed a compromise bill to end the import tax by 1842. South Carolina's congressman accepted the compromise, and the state's legislature called another convention. This time, the delegates voted to end the Nullification Act they had approved earlier. They did not, however, give up their belief in the idea of nullification. Daniel Feller says one reason is because Southern politicians thought they might need to use nullification later. An anti-slavery movement was beginning to grow in the country. Some Southerners worried that Congress would one day make laws they did not like against slavery. The issues of slavery and states' rights would continue to be areas of conflict. Eventually, they would help start the Civil War in 1861. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.